Kia ora and welcome. I'm Boris Lamont and you're listening to the New Zealand Wine Podcast. Thanks for joining us. In this episode, we're speaking with Nigel Alder from the Alder Pinot in Martinborough here in New Zealand. We talk with Nigel about his life leading up to establishing himself in Martinborough and working initially with some of the prestigious winemakers there and then setting out on his own. So let's go have a chat with Nigel. Hi, Nigel.
G'day, Boris. How you doing?
I'm well, thanks. Thanks for coming on the podcast, I should say. Great to have you on, and looking forward to hearing your story. So where did that first start for you, your journey into the wine world?
Well, that's quite a tricky question to reflect upon. It goes back a long way. I think certainly on my mother's side of the family, we did have a history of drinking pretty good wine. I certainly remember my first taste of champagne, probably in my early teens, and I sort of definitely trace it back to that, to those days.
Yeah, so it was there was something memorable for you, maybe that, you know, the occasion as well. Yeah,
Certainly weddings and sort of major family gatherings, there was always a decent drop available.
Yeah, and so your parents obviously enjoyed wine. They were into nice wines. And
again, on my mother's side, yes, not so much my father. He was much more of a beer man. So
yeah, sure. Yeah, okay. So it's some early memories back then for you of wine, but you didn't sort of go straight into wine, did you? As a career or anything from a young age?
Indirectly, my exposure to the much more to the hospitality industry rather than the wine production side was at university. I went to Victoria in Wellington, and we'll come to how I ended up there. But my need for a part-time job led me to doing a bit of waitering, as happens for many students. And I ended up working at the legendary Il Casino in Wellington. Ramiro Breslin and his family were the owners and founders of that. And that really gave me my first taste of that combination of good food, good wine, a great environment, and you know, sort of enjoyable times being experienced by the diners, by the customers. And that was great exposure at the time.
Yeah, nice. I mean, that was a real institution, wasn't it? And so, did you grow up in Wellington, or did you go there for study?
Just for study, I grew up in the UK. My father was in the military. He did 22 odd years of service. In that time, we lived all over the world. We'd been in Hong Kong, Germany, Bahrain, Singapore, other places I've since forgotten. But at the end of that time, he decided he wanted to move away from the UK. And he applied for a few different places to move to. And New Zealand was the first to say yes. So that's how we ended up here. He was an engineer. He was able to get a job pretty readily. And the whole family packed up and moved out to New Zealand. We spent a year in the first year in Wellington, but at the end of that, we moved over to the Wairarapa. We moved to a little area in between Carterton and Marston called Clareville, and that was where I sort of spent my teenage years.
Right. Okay. So you moved. You were sort of mid to late teens when you moved to New Zealand then?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Okay. And then from there, when finished high school, off to university in Wellington.
Yeah, it was sort of the natural choice to, you know, hop on the train and just go over the hill and end up in Wellington. I had a lot of friends there, and it was easy to find somewhere to live, find somewhere to work. And I think probably the connection coming back to Il Casino and sort of the early days in hospitality was that was when the wine industry, the grape growing and winemaking in the Wairarapa was in its very early infancy. So we're sort of talking mid-80s here. And you know, the sort of pioneers of the region were getting started.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So yeah, sort of coming together then of a few things there at the right time for you being around and in this. Yeah. And what were you studying at university?
I did commerce, the Bachelor of Commerce and Administration, which was kind of generic, useful in many respects, but not a lot to do with winemaking.
No. No. Okay. So worked a little bit in hospitality, and what was next for you after finishing your degree?
After that, I moved up to Auckland briefly. I think it was for about 6 months. Didn't particularly enjoy the big city then. And someone offered me a role in Vanuatu, of all places. So I moved overseas pretty smartly after graduating.
Wow. Okay. So that's quite a change. What were you doing in Vanuatu?
I was working for an Australian aviation entrepreneur. He was a Queenslander, and I was an Aussie guy called Dennis Buchanan. And he owned a number of small regional sort of third level airlines in Queensland, Solomon Islands, Vanuatu, and Papua New Guinea. And I guess I was sort of helping him reduce his tax burden, as it were.
Okay. All right. So that's quite a that's quite an interesting role when you know just out of university, pretty much to do with your commerce.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. It was a great place. You know, it was still pretty wild and very much a frontier back then. It was something that probably the main benefit I got out of that was that all the sort of, you know, young males or sort of my sort of contemporary set were all French, because it was very much a sort of combined French British territory. Had that sort of colonial legacy, and so if I wanted to be social, I had to learn to speak French pretty quickly. So I was made a great group of French buddies who are still friends today, who I still have regular contact with, and sort of gave me a foot in the door with French language and culture, which came in useful much later on.
Yeah, nice. And that's cool. How long were you up there for?
Just on 3 years.
Wow. Okay. So good stint. And I suppose having, you know, been with your family and your dad moving around the world, it was probably something that did it feel like it wasn't, it was something that you could easily do, sort of move somewhere and stay for a while and work and.
I certainly didn't find it challenging. I think when you move a lot when you're younger, you definitely find it easier to adjust to a new situation, to adjust to a new place to live, to make friends and acquaintances pretty quickly.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, oh, very good. And then 3 years there, and what was the next step for you?
Well, after that, I'd suddenly had a bit more exposure to the wider world, more through sort of the business contacts. You know, the people I was dealing with in while I was living in Vanuatu were in Australia, they were in the UK and various other parts of the world, and I got itchy feet and decided it was time to go to London. So sort of packed my bags and flew pretty much straight to London.
Yeah, wow. Okay. And again, quite different to where you were then, obviously, in Vanuatu. Had you spent any time when you were younger in London itself? Or?
No, I certainly never lived there or had any real desire to experience London life prior to then.
Yeah.
But a lot of people do or did, OE was a big thing for young Kiwis, still is, I guess. But I had a number of friends who'd already moved over there by then. So I had connections and acquaintances that I could get in touch with as soon as I arrived. Or, in fact, somewhere to live, actually. I remember crashing on someone's couch for a couple of months.
Yes. Nice. Yeah. It certainly used to happen a lot, probably, as you say, probably still does. And what did you end up doing in London? Did you stay in London itself for a while?
Yeah, I stayed in London off and on. Initially, I was there for about 6 months. At that point, I wanted to reconnect with a few of my French acquaintances. So I managed to get a job in Paris and went over and lived in Paris for a year. You know, sort of polished up the French language and got a bit of French culture, which was a great exposure at the time.
Yeah, great. Yeah, again, obviously, having had that basis from Vanuatu, that was pretty cool. And you were still doing commerce related work?
Yes, yeah. I was working for a French oil services company called Schlumberger. They're not an oil producer. They just provide the sort of drilling and logging services to the actual oil producers themselves. So it was again very much in the sort of financial side of things, helping them pay less tax as well.
Yeah. And sorry, where did you say you were? You were living in France at that time. You went.
Yeah, so I was living in Paris. I was living in the 14th arrondissement, the sort of southeast of Paris, which is a lovely spot.
Yeah, and enjoyed that.
Loved it. Yeah, fantastic time. Again, I was sort of, by that stage, I was sort of starting to explore a bit more in the wine world as a consumer. So it was fantastic to have access to a much wider range of wines, or predominantly French, but I was able to start tasting stuff I'd never seen before, never heard of before, and that was a really good opportunity.
Nice. And so dining out as well, or sort of more sort of having wine at home or mix?
A bit of both. And I was earning pretty good money at that point, working in the corporate world, and I could certainly afford to buy the sort of higher shelves in the supermarket.
Mm. Yeah. Nice. Okay, and then so there for a year.
Yeah. Yeah, and then back to London. Again, I was sort of doing a bit more intermittent work in hospitality at that point, but I started getting itchy feet from a different perspective. I'd always wanted to be a paratrooper. I'd always wanted to jump out of planes, and I joined the British Army and was a paratrooper for a few years. That was quite a contrast to what I'd been doing prior to that.
Yeah, absolutely. So you just, as you say, you just had that sort of there, sitting there, and felt like you needed to scratch that itch and go and do that and try it out.
Yeah. I was living in Chelsea, and I was walking along the King's Road one day, and they had a recruiting office. There was an old army barracks on the King's Road, and I was walking past, and there was this recruiting office, and the door was open, and it was for the parachute regiment, so I walked in and signed on the dotted line on the spot.
Wow. Good on you. So then what was that part of your journey like? So how long did you have before you were sort of into training? And
I was pretty much instantaneous. They don't mess around. And so there was quite a demanding preparation period, just to get you fit and get you ready for the selection process. It was quite by a long shot, the hardest thing I've ever done in my life, certainly from both a sort of physical and mental perspective. I think if the numbers are correct, about 140 odd people were in the same intake as me, and less than 30 successfully completed it.
Right. Okay. Yep. So sounds pretty intense and rigorous. And then you were based in the UK after that?
Yes, but traveling a lot. We were all away most of the year. I was in Norway for winter, Canada for summer, on exercise here and there and everywhere. It was a pretty intense pace of life.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. And how long were you doing that for?
That was probably the best part of 5 years.
Wow. Yep. So lots of travel, lots of again exposure to different places, doing something different again.
Yeah.
Any particular highlights for you of that period?
I think spending a winter in Norway as part of the sort of ski patrol frontier. We were skiing every day. We slept out in tents and minus 30 degrees. Towed everything round with you on a little sledge. You had to be very independent. And then when we got a day off, we went skiing at the Olympic ski resort. So I got pretty good. We all got pretty good at going downhill on skis.
Yeah, no, I can imagine. So that would have been a long stint then in snow and cold and in that environment.
Yeah. Learning the survival skills, how to operate, how to work with helicopters, how to do everything at sort of sub-zero temperatures, which is quite challenging. But thoroughly enjoyed the experience.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. And so 5 years doing that. And then what sort of got you to the decision to do something different?
Towards the end of that, I was starting to think about, what next? And I became aware of, I guess, wine education opportunities. I started to think about, where I'd like to, get into the production side of things a little bit more. As a sort of part time, I'd done a couple of the Wine and Spirit Education Trust courses. After I got out of the British Army, I was still living in London in Battersea and did a bit of part time work for a retailer distributor. So helping sell wine, helping get it into restaurants, etc. And I started looking at education opportunities, considered Roseworthy, a couple of the French universities, but ultimately I settled on Blenheim. I really liked the look of the NMIT course down there, and decided it was time to get on with it.
Good. Okay. And so looked at a few different options and thought coming back to New Zealand was one that looked best for you.
Yeah. I mean, I think, by that point, I'd had a couple of New Zealand wines that really, opened my eyes to the potential of what we can do here. What we, mm-hmm. it was, it was early days, I think. The first, yeah, I think everyone remembers the first really good wine they've drunk. And for me, it was the Neudorf Blackbird Valley Claret from Nelson was the wine that really opened my eyes to it. You know, not something that Neudorf were particularly well known for, but no. It was just a remarkably good wine. And this would have been, I can't remember what vintage it was, but it would have been mid-80s. And I think I would have had that in either the late 80s or early 90s. And it was just spoke to me. It just said, this is a pointer as to how, much potential we have in New Zealand. So yeah, that was sort of the deciding factor in coming back here rather than deciding to study anywhere else.
Yeah, nice. Okay. So yeah, had that experience, and a good wine can certainly do that, can't it? It can cement itself in your memory. And I suppose it coincided with what was happening in the New Zealand wine industry as well, and where it was starting to go. Yeah.
And so from that point onwards, I started, enthusiastically seeking out sort of the better New Zealand wines and, buying them, consuming them, and, putting a few away in the cellar, which a couple I've still got today, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Wow. Got a Waiheke Stony Ridge La Rose unopened. A couple of old Coleraines. So might have to crack them open one of these days.
Yeah. Some good New Zealand classics, those two. Very good. And so what was the length of study there for you?
So that was a 1 year diploma, I think it was. It was 1 year combined winemaking and viticulture.
Mm-hmm. And you enjoyed that?
Felt like really enjoyed that.
Yeah.
Got to do some good internship periods at Vavasor, and started pruning down at Oyster Bay in the Awatere Valley.
And did you get a feel for where you wanted to go particularly within the wine industry, or?
Not really. At that point, I was enjoying both aspects of production, indoors and outdoors. I was open to doing both, and started looking for somewhere where I could do both. I don't mind a bit of cellar work, but I'm just as happy outside in the vineyard. So yeah, I was, on graduation, I went over to Australia and did a vintage in the Hunter Valley, which was a fairly traumatic experience, I have to say.
Oh yeah, why was that?
Well, I was working there. I went
to Australia.
The Aussies were wonderful, but the winery wasn't. I was working at a very large, pretty industrial winery. I won't say who it was, but it was sort of 5,000 tons plus, which was big at the time. Just sort of seeing that aspect of production where, these huge articulated trucks would come in and they would just, sort of dump 10 tons of fruit into the hopper. And, they would just be pumped, 500 meters away to the nearest press. And you'd add in a couple of buckets of acid and a couple of buckets of, enzymes, and you never see it again. there'd be snakes and posts and lizards and all kinds of stuff in the must.
Yeah, creating a very unique Australian thing.
But it was useful because it gave me a pointer on where I didn't want to go. I quickly realized that I did not want to be involved in this sort of industrial side of wine production. I wanted to sort of keep it small and, be a lot more hands-on and, see the process from beginning to end.
Yeah.
So fortunately, after I got back from Australia, I was able to go and find a job at Gladstone Vineyard, just outside Carterton, sort of north of Martinborough. I had 6 months there, and I was doing everything, vineyard, winery, the works.
Yeah, nice. Okay. Gladstone's still going, isn't it?
Still going. Back then it was Christine and David Kernahan, they weren't the founders. They bought it off the original founders who set it up in the 80s, but they had it for a good few years and made some very nice wines in the time they were there.
Yeah, right. Okay. So we're talking, what, late 80s now, early 90s?
Sort of mid-90s.
Mid-90s,
yeah.
Okay.
Mid to late 90s, yeah.
Yeah. And what was it like as a region then for wine?
It was still fairly nascent. There had been a few there had been a few good wines made. Obviously, so the early days of Larry McKenna and Clive Payton had started to put it on the map, but I don't think it really hadn't really consolidated its position at that point. It was still still finding its feet. It was less than 20 years old, I guess, and still seeking identity.
Yep, sure. Okay. And so working at Gladstone for a while, you did a few vintages?
No, I didn't. I didn't even do one, to be honest. Oh. I finished off the tail end of one, but and then towards the end of that year, I was lucky enough to get a job at Marlborough Vineyard.
Right.
I was very raw and inexperienced, but I thought I'd put my name in the hat anyway. And they obviously liked some of the qualities I brought, and I was able to get something well beyond my experience. But I was ready for it, I think. So that was I was the viticulturalist at Martinborough Vineyard at that point.
Okay, nice. And so, who were you working alongside at that time?
That was Larry McKenna. So, to have the opportunity to work with Larry was fantastic.
Mm, mm. Yeah, no, that's certainly quite an opportunity, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely was.
Yeah. And it felt like you learnt a lot there?
Oh, definitely, yeah. Having that exposure to mature vineyard that had a history of producing great wines already was, it's really, really helped me start to understand clonal differences better. What the different components to a blend can come from, or how they can be separated as a individual wines. Really sort of helped me get my head around what Pinot Noir can actually be.
Okay, and so we're talking now still sort of mid 90s, just heading off towards late 90s, and you spend a bit of time there.
Yeah, so I did. I was about 8 years or so at Martinborough Vineyard.
Yeah. Okay, and pretty much focused on the same role the whole time.
Yeah. And but I guess as time went by, I sort of had the opportunity to get a little bit more involved in the sort of marketing and promotional side, and found I quite enjoyed that. Doing dinners, promotional events, and activities, which I really enjoyed. So put myself forward to those at every opportunity.
Yeah, nice. Anything particularly stands out for you in those years?
I think there were two things. First one was that we realized that at some point we realized we were going to need a second label, just because there was quite a lot of Pinot Noir being made, and it wasn't all top quality. It wasn't all suitable for the sort of main label, as it were. And there wasn't a lot of value in selling it off in bulk. That had been done a little bit in the past, but we took that opportunity to develop the second label for Martinborough Vineyard, which became Titerra. And it was sort of good working through that process of, how do we come up with a brand and a name, and, what's the, qualification for wines that go under that label. And then at the opposite end of the spectrum, we also developed the Marie Zélie, which took over from the what had been the reserve. I don't know if anyone remembers the Martinborough Vineyard reserve label from the sort of mid-90s, but it was a bit of a shocker. So it was nice to rebrand that as the Marie Zélie, as one of the sort of original founders of wine production in the Wairarapa, going back to the late 1800s. For those who know the story of the Beetham family vineyards up in Marstonborough, in Masterson. That was a high point.
Right. Okay. Tell us a little bit about that. You've just referred to the Beetham family. Is that right?
Yeah. So the, William Beetham was, one of the sort of, big landowners in the early days of European settlement of the Wairarapa, mid to late 1800s. He owned huge areas of land from basically from Masterson right out to the coast towards sort of Castle Point and that area. And he was married to French woman Marie Zélie, between them they bought that desire to produce good wines for the family table and other activities. They put the first vineyard in the Wairarapa, which was to the north, on the north side of Masterton, an area called Lansdowne. These days it's a suburb. Back then it would have been a sort of a slope, nice sloping, sun exposed hill. They planted some Pinot, made some great wines, some of which I believe still exists in the old Beetham family home, out in Wainuiaru to the east of Masterton. The demise of that came about with the introduction of prohibition to New Zealand, and the vines probably got pulled out. But it's a great story, and it's good to have that early history in the Wairarapa of wine production.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, no, that's great. Certainly, it would be pretty fascinating if some of those wines are still around somewhere. And so 8 years with Mount River Vineyards, what moved you on from there?
There was I wouldn't say it was a takeover, but Martin Revineyard went through an ownership change, and the original shareholders, the Milne brothers and Russell Schultz, sold down a bit of their holdings to a group of investors, and it changed the dynamic. Made me realise that it wasn't the same place that I joined a few years before, so I decided it was time for a change. Moved on from Martin River Vineyards, and sort of kept my hand in the game for a couple of years, just doing vineyard consultancy and working with a couple of different growers to help them improve the quality of their fruit. Then 2010 decided it was time to get back into production. I started the Elder Pinot.
And so what was that about? Did you do planting, or you took on something that was already established? How did the Elder Pinot
go? At Martinborough, I'd been working with a couple of different contract growers who were providing fruits in addition to the company's own vineyards. And I think it was a fallout of the sort of global financial crisis when sales plummeted and a lot of wineries cut back on their production, and Martin River Vineyard was no exception. They had to let a couple of their contract growers go. So I saw an opportunity to work with one of them out in the beautiful Tamuna Valley, which is sort of a little bit southeast of Martinborough. Their fruit became available, so leapt on that opportunity. And
yeah, cool. And so what was your vision then, do you think, for what you were wanting to achieve?
Because I'd had the opportunity to do a bit of work in France, do a bit of work in Burgundy with a couple of very good producers, Domaine Dujac and a couple of others, I wanted to explore the concept of single vineyard wines a little bit more. I think in those days, even though it's not that long ago, there was still a tendency to make all the wine, blend it all together, and then release it as a single wine. So most wines were a combination of multiple vineyards or more than one vineyard, and not necessarily homogenous, but they didn't have an individual identity. And that was the concept I wanted to explore. How do we look at what different parcels of land are capable of producing, and how do they taste as single vineyards? So that was the original driver for me.
For Pinot as a varietal, then to me that would sound like my simple understanding is that Pinot Noir is a difficult grape to work with. Does that intensify or that level of difficulty by then going, okay, we're only going to look at grapes from just this vineyard and see what we can do with that?
I think you make yourself a lot more vulnerable to seasonal variation. If you have a tough year, one vineyard, gives you a very low crop and you're still intent upon making a single vineyard from it, you might not have very much wine. Whereas if you're combining vineyards to produce your overall blend, then you've got a bit more flexibility. Or you can, you know, potentially buy in fruit or juice from elsewhere. So it does make it a bit more challenging, but, you know, you just have to learn how to work with the, you know, the seasonal variation and roll with the conditions from year to year.
Yeah. And so would that then mean that you're just more accommodating of what it is that you're given for that particular season and then going,
Definitely,
is this expressing to us? And
you have to sort of build a certain level of resilience to deal with those annual changes. But I think it also gives you opportunity to see how those seasonal variations express themselves from a single site rather than sort of a multi-site blend. I think that's the exciting side of it.
Mm. And has it ever led to you going, okay, well, we're actually not going to produce this year?
Only in 2023, actually. I've been able to produce Pinot off the site in Tamuna every year from 2010 onwards. But 2023 was obviously a very challenging year for the North Island, not so much the South Island, but very much the North Island. And yeah, just had to make some tough calls.
Wow, is that right? Okay. Yeah. So, you know, 13, 14 years, seasons into it, that was it's the one that you actually had to just give away. Yeah. And that, as you mentioned, that's because of the weather.
Yeah. Yeah. It was just such a challenging season. I wouldn't say completely given it away. So what I've had to do is develop a different label. It's not the Elder Pinot, but it's a different label that will, I think, better suit a sort of lighter style of wine that we got for the year.
Yeah. Okay. How would you describe how you look at producing Pinot now? Has that evolved for you? And if so, in what way since 2010 to what you do now?
What I've come to realize is certainly with the sort of one foot in the hospitality side of the business and one foot in the production side of the business is the realization that the restaurant industry has changed a lot. You know, I've always had a strong focus on direct sales to restaurants and hospitality for various reasons. And as that industry's changed, most of the restaurants that traditionally would have had a cellar or would have had stock, have really cut back on that. So the opportunity for them to age their own wines is pretty much gone. So what I've decided to do is to focus on doing that myself. So I now keep the Pinot a lot longer before releasing it. I think you have to, you know, good Pinot does need time in bottle. And if that's not going to get it elsewhere, you have to take it upon yourself to give it that optimum time before releasing it for consumption.
Right. Okay. And that has led to you having the library where you hold back on it. And does that depend on year to year as to how long you think it needs to stay in bottle? Or do you think there's more or less a minimum number of years?
I think that there's a bit of flexibility from year to year, but at the same time, there is a sort of fairly general sweet spot. And what I'm finding, certainly for the wines I've made up to now, it's around that sort of 5 to 6 years old. You know, Pinot Noir, when it's had 5 years in bottle, is just awesome compared to Pinot Noir that's only had 12 months in bottle.
Yeah.
That's the sort of point I'm working to. Current release is 2019. So that's, you know, it's looking really good at the moment.
Yeah. Nice. Is there anything that you're sort of looking at now that's different to maybe how you're approaching things, or anything that's different for coming up for you on the horizon, or new for you in what you're doing?
I'm now working with a range of different growers from different appellations around Martinborough. So, out in Tamuna Valley, in the sort of heavier soils to the south of Martinborough, and in the centre of Martinborough itself, where it's a lot more stony and perhaps a little bit warmer. And yeah, I'm just sort of keen to explore, I guess, for want of a better term, the sub appellations of Martinborough. I think it's, you know, it is a sort of not a particularly big area, but it does have a lot of complexity in the geology and the geography. And I think there's a lot more to be done to understand how the different parts of the area can make different wines.
Right. Okay. So you're working alongside winemakers and the vineyard owners in trying to look for those expressions?
Yeah. Particularly with, as we start to get a bit more vine age in the area, you know, there's plenty of vines now which are sort of 20, 30, you know, going on 40 years old. So I think that will help change the dynamic as well. And I really want to see what that brings to the party.
Wow. Okay. Well, that sounds interesting. Seeing what's there and the differences.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I've been fortunate enough, as I sort of said earlier, to spend a bit of time working in Burgundy, and, you know, and some of the vineyards there are sort of, you know, 60 or 80 years old, or not the vineyards, but the plants themselves are 60 to 80 years old. And you really see, the sort of finesse and elegance that comes with age. And I think we don't really understand in certainly in Martinborough, and not so much in New Zealand either, you know, what is the optimum age for our vines? What are they capable of? How long can they, how long can they produce effectively? You know, while the quality increases, the yield tends to go down quite quickly. And, you know, what's the sweet spot at which we need to replace those vineyards, and how do we keep them healthy in the meantime?
Those challenges of the, you know, relatively young industry, I suppose, and those learnings are to come.
Yeah.
And anything else outside of what you're doing, maybe in New Zealand, that's piqued your interest, that you're seeing someone else doing, or, you know, a different varietal appearing, or something you might have had recently?
I'm excited by the relatively recent resurgence of Chenin Blanc. You know, back in the sort of 80s, you had a couple of good Chenin Blanc producers, Collard Brothers come to mind, and a couple of others. But then it seemed to fade away for a couple of decades. But, you know, in the last sort of, you know, 3 to 5 years, there's been a lot more people putting out Chenin Blanc. It's fantastic. I think it's, you know, it's the most versatile white grape. It produces just sublime wines. And I'm really excited to see that, you know, New Zealand can start doing more with that.
Yeah, great. In any particular region that you've seen these come out of, or you're seeing them in a few different spots?
It certainly seems to suit the sort of East Coast of North Island really well. Obviously, you know, it's sort of origins back in France, the Loire Valley, and sort of warmer, perhaps slightly more humid regions. But, you know, people are making it in Marlborough, people are making it in central Otago, and it's great to sort of push the boundaries on and see what it can be done, see what can be done with the variety.
Yeah, nice. Very good. Very good. Well, that's great. Thanks, Nigel. We finish on the question. If you could have any glass of wine with anyone, anywhere and at any time, who and where and what and when would that be?
Well, that's a very challenging question, because the yes. parameters are so broad and so many opportunities. But I think what I'd really like to do is to go back to the early days of Martinborough. Those early founders, we're talking about Neil McCullum of Dry River, Clive Payton of Artarangi, the Milne brothers and Russell Schultz of Martinborough Vineyard, and not to forget Stan Shifney, who wasn't really around to see that much of the success, but he was still very much one of those early contributors. I'd like to sit around with that bunch of people and drink something from Burgundy, you know, probably a really nice sort of a lighter style, you know, Chambord Mousigny, maybe a Volnay or Santenay, something from one of those lovely, elegant Burgundy appellations.
Nice.
That would do me.
Yeah, that sounds good. And sit in Martinborough and see what some of them think of the changes.
Yeah,
very good. Oh, that's great. Well, thanks, Nigel. Appreciate you taking the time to be with us on the podcast.
My pleasure, Boris. Thank you.
And looking forward to seeing some of these library releases starting to come out and be available.
Will do.
All righty. Thanks, Nigel.
Thank you.
Bye for now.
Bye.
You've been listening to the New Zealand Wine Podcast, where we've been speaking with Nigel Alder from the Alder Pinot in Martinborough here in New Zealand. You can find them on thealderpinot.com, and the link is also in the description for the podcast. If you've enjoyed listening to the podcast, please click subscribe or follow in your podcast app. And also be sure to check out some of the other great podcasts about things happening here in New Zealand on podcast.nz. We look forward to your company again very shortly. Mā te wā. Bye for now.